It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is Trey. Thank you for joining us for a Tuesday edition of our podcast. We are joined today by one of my very favorite people to listen to read, to talk with. In fact, before I pushed the play button on this recording, I could have talked to him for, I'm sure he felt like it was an hour. I could have talked to him for a solid hour. Simply, he was explaining to me, Albert Camus, who's the author of The Stranger and A Happy Death and The Myth of Sisyphus and some other things. He was a conservative thought leader who shifted to the classroom and academia. That's the way I would describe it. He might describe it differently. He never was a politician, even though he was around public policy and had access to the highest echelons of politics. Now he is, or maybe he always was, but now he is known as an expert on happiness, the pursuit of happiness, what it is, what it is not. So what better time to talk about that and hope and renewal and new beginnings than spring and right after Easter? He's a prolific author. And I guess the most important thing of all is he is someone my wife, Terry, really loves when he is on this podcast. I hope she listens the other weeks. She says she does, but I know she listens when Arthur Brooks is on. So welcome, Professor. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Trey. Great to see you. Great to talk to you, as always. I look forward to this.
I do, too. I was enjoying our conversation before they made me push the record button. I think Tim Fox just says, look, you can't take up his entire day asking him questions you've always wanted to ask him. All right. Out of respect for my wife, I do want to ask you about happiness and joy and all that stuff. But out of respect for my own cynicism, I want to start the way I want to start. Is unhappiness the opposite of happiness? People say they think hate is the opposite of love, and I think it's indifference. I think hate requires a lot of passion and emotion and attention and energy, so I don't think it's the opposite. Is unhappiness the opposite of happiness, or is there something else?
It's a lot more complicated than that. And first of all, hey, Terry, I'm glad to be talking to you. This episode is for you, Terry. Talking about happiness and unhappiness is something that I teach my students at the Harvard Business School. Believe it or not, we have this science of happiness class that's got 180 students in it and like 400 on the waiting list. And, you know, because everybody wants to be happier as people. One of the first topics we talk about is what is happiness, which is not a feeling. It's a combination of enjoyment with your life and satisfaction with your accomplishments and a sense of meaning in life. And then we talk about unhappiness, how important it is and what it actually is. Happiness and unhappiness are largely processed in different parts of the brain. They're associated. They're not feelings, but they're associated with different sets of feelings. There's positive and negative emotions. We all know that. The problem is that we don't know what emotions are or what they're for. They're produced in a part of the brain called the limbic system, and they're nothing more than signals about what's going on outside you and how you're supposed to feel about things. You know, there's things that are good for you and things that are bad for you. There's opportunities and threats. And when there's threats around you that somebody might abandon you or hurt you, that gives you negative emotions. Those negative emotions are data. They help you react in an appropriate way, but they're not going to make you happy, or they're not going to be associated with happiness. On the contrary, negative emotions, they make you feel negative about your life at any given time. And they're supposed to. If you didn't have them, Trey, you'd be dead in like a week, is what it comes down to. And they're produced literally in different parts of your brain. So for the longest time, people thought, well, unhappiness is the absence of happiness. That's completely wrong. You can be an unusually happy and an unusually happy person. Unhappy person. That's called a high affect person, somebody who has just really strong positive and negative emotions. A quarter of the population fits into that category. They're called mad scientists. in you know, in the basic literature. There's some people who are unusually, you know, positive and have low intensity negative emotions. Those are cheerleaders. You've got some who are low positive and low negative. Those are judges. You know, those are the people who are low affect people. And there are people who are high negative and low positive. Those are the poets, who tend to feel things, negative emotions, very strongly, and they tend to also be really creative people. So that's a quarter of the population each, and everybody listening to us fits into one of those personality profiles. If you're feeling a lot of negative emotions, there's nothing wrong with you at all. The problem is that we're telling everybody that if you're feeling a lot of negative emotions, that you're screwed up, that you're broken, there's something wrong with you. And that's completely unscientific. That's a terrible way to live your life. And it's a bad message to give your kids. But that's what we're doing all the time these days.
How, if someone said, you know what, I've never heard it explained. I mean, I've heard about this test I take online and figure out whether I'm an extrovert or introvert, but I've never heard anyone say that I might be a cheerleader or a poet, other than getting on that very lengthy wait list to sign up for your class at Harvard. How can someone figure out? Because, you know, Arthur, I for 20 years was surrounded by homicide. You're not supposed to be happy as a homicide prosecutor. Something right. is wrong with you. But I don't think there's something wrong with me. I think it was what I saw, and therefore right. it's what I reacted to. How do people figure out what they are?
So that's a test, an actual test, a psychometric test called the PANAS test, PANAS, positive affect, negative affect sequence. And there's a really easy way to do it and figure out which profile you are. I actually have it on my website for free, completely free of cost at arthurbrooks.com. And you can go there and take the test and you can find out what personality profile you are. And no matter what you find, there's nothing wrong with you. Now, look, people can have exaggerated negative emotion that's too much and be clinically depressed or, you know, have generalized anxiety. But that doesn't mean that sadness and stress are bad on their face. On the contrary, everybody feels those things. I tell my students, look, you study at Harvard. If you're not sad and anxious, then you need therapy because, man. And the truth is that we've been screwing up our kids for a really long time by saying that if they're feeling emotional pain, then that's something they need to get treated immediately. They need to wipe it out, or that sadness is a switch. Either you're depressed or not depressed. Either you're anxious or not anxious. And all that is nonsense. Once you understand your personality and your emotional intensity profile, you can do a ton with that. So you had appropriate emotions given the fact that you were a prosecutor dealing with bad guys. So my guess is, I've known you for several years. I'm just going to guess based on our conversations that you're probably also a mad scientist like I am. You probably feel a lot of intensity of both your positive and your negative emotions, which is great. It makes you much better running a business or, you know, being a politician for sure. But it's also hard to be married to. And, you know, Terry is shaking her head right now, right? And I'm a super mad scientist. I mean, it's like, and my wife reminded me this morning that it's very hard to be married to mad scientists.
Well, it's not hard to talk to you. I've never been married to you, but it's fascinating to talk to you. All right. I want to, you mentioned a couple of myths, and then you and I were talking off air about the myth of Sisyphus. I want to ask you about a couple of other myths. Yeah. Money is a complicated thing. We were brought up being told money will not make you happy. And right. But I always tell people, but it makes my unhappiness easier to tolerate is what I used to tell people. Money doesn't make you happy, I guess, but maybe sometimes it does. So what does money have to do with being happy or unhappy?
Yeah, we actually know the answer to that because there's been a whole lot of research on that by, you know, nerds like me. I'm actually trained as an economist. So the first topic I looked into in my research when I started moving over to happiness was money and happiness. Now, it's true, money doesn't buy happiness unless you use it in the right way. So it's kind of two questions. Number one is when you do the typical things with it, like going and buying stuff, that won't bring happiness. What it will do when you're poor is it will relieve the sources of unhappiness. And what I mean by that is that a lot of unhappiness comes because of deprivation. So if you don't have health care for your kids, if you're not meeting your nutritional needs, if you're worried about your rent, that's really going to make you extremely unhappy. And a little bit of money will relieve that. That's one of the reasons that people will notice early in life when they tend to have a lot less money that they get something and they feel a lot better. And then they chase that feeling of feeling better when they get more money, even though they're above the threshold. The data say that it's about $75,000 a year in most parts of the country that will eliminate the sources of unhappiness. And after that, it doesn't buy any more well-being is the problem. But so the first point is money will, at low levels, will relieve sources of unhappiness. And that's one of the reasons we have a safety net, Trey. I mean, we want a safety net so that we can have the well-being of people not be below what it should be. And you and I believe in a safety net. I mean, which, by the way, the only reason we can have a welfare safety net is because of capitalism. The only reason that we have enough largesse in our, you know, we have enough extra money in our economy is because people are really productive. But it's a great thing. The problem is when, you know, everybody's in the safety net. And so you get above that level, you're not doing in well-being. You're not creating well-being for anybody. Second part that's really interesting, however, is that there are ways that you can use your money that will reliably raise your happiness. They're just not the things you naturally think of. There's five ways to use money. You can buy stuff. You can buy experiences with people you love. You can buy time that you can use as you see fit. You can give your money away and you can save your money. Those are the five things that you can do. Now, what everybody wants to do is to buy the house, the car, the watch, you know, the clothes. And that doesn't bring happiness, even though your brain is telling you that it will, because your brain was evolved during the Pleistocene when you were trying to survive and get mates. And so that's all. Mother Nature doesn't care if you're happy, Trey. Mother Nature just wants you to survive and pass on your genes. And so accumulating stuff like, you know, having more animal skins and flints and buffalo jerky in your cave, good for you. Two thumbs up. You're going to make it through the winter. But, you know, guess what? You know, if you're living in, you know, a beautiful home in South Carolina, you don't need that much buffalo jerky anymore. So experiences with people you love, that will reliably bring happiness. You know, bring your kids together, do a thing together. Buy time. And by the way, spread the love, man, by creating a job for somebody else. If you have the money so you don't have to cut your yard, hire somebody to cut your yard, man. I mean, give somebody an opportunity and then use the time. Don't fritter it away on, you know, Facebook or something stupid like that. Use the time with people that you love. Go hang out with your wife. Go hang out with your kids. Do something that's really meaningful. Go for a run. Third is you can give your money away. You know, give your money to your church, give your money to a cause you really care about that's really useful. And last but not least, there's tons of research that shows when you save money, you get happier. By the way, when you borrow money, you get unhappier. The most unhappiness provoking thing you can do with money is to run a credit card balance. That will reliably lower your happiness month after month. Don't, I sound like Dave Ramsey. Don't run a credit card balance. But he's talking about it for common sense. I'm talking about it because of love and happiness.
Do you think saving money, I find that fascinating. I am not surprised about spending money on memories that last a lifetime, because I went with a group of friends to Israel, and I really think the memories made on that trip will be some of the last things we think about before we go wherever we're going. But yeah. You mentioned saving money. Yeah. Do you think it's because it buys you security, and security is tantamount to happiness?
No, the real reason is because it's a mark of progress. Every dollar you put in the bank is progress towards something, progress toward making sure that you're, you know, your kids are taken care of adequately, progress toward being able to buy a house at some point. Progress toward, yeah, toward greater safety as you get older, but it's the progress per se. Humans are made for progress. And with the biggest mistake that we make is thinking that if I finally get to a goal, then I'll be just blissfully happy. And we're not. That's called the arrival fallacy in psychology, where people get to a goal and then they're depressed because it's not as good as they thought it was going to be. That's the reason that Olympic athletes who win a medal, they tend to be depressed in the month after they win the Olympic medals. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, I was very depressed for like a month after I got my PhD, because I'm like, I'm making progress. I'm working really hard. And I got the PhD. I'm like, huh, you know, it's okay. You know, that's the arrival fallacy. The whole point is making progress. An interesting case of this, by the way, Trey, is that weight loss is a big deal for a lot of people in the United States, because a lot of people are trying to lose weight all the time. Almost all diets work. The problem is that they don't work for you know, permanently. The reason is because you get a lot of good feeling every time the scale goes down. That's progress. But when you hit your ultimate goal, the reward is never getting to eat what you like ever again for the rest of your life. Congratulations, right? And so the result of that is that that's the ultimate arrival fallacy. And so something like 80% return to their old weight and beyond within the first year. And the other 20% develop an eating disorder. They keep going beyond their weight goal because they want to keep getting some benefit back from it. That's why diets are a complete catastrophe in most cases for precisely these sets of behavioral reasons we're talking about.
You call it the arrival fallacy. I had a Sunday school teacher when I was in the eighth grade who used to always say anticipation was better than realization. Yeah. And that's what I remember. I don't remember many Bible verses, but I remember him kind of say, like, looking forward to doing something was always better than once you actually got there. I say always, that's a big word, but almost always.
Pretty much, because our brains are wired for that. There's a neuromodulator in our brain called dopamine. Almost everybody who's listening to us knows about dopamine. It's this neurochemical. And people think it's a pleasure chemical. It's not. All it does is makes you crave. It's the anticipation of reward. So you're thinking right now, I mean, like you and I are talking, we're recording this around 11 o'clock in the morning, and I'm thinking, man, a roast beef sandwich would really hit the spot. As soon as I think that means the dopamine kicks over into my brain and I get the craving for it. So they'll have the incentive to pursue the reward. Now, that's a little bit of dopamine. If I were addicted to cocaine or methamphetamine, I would spike my dopamine by a factor of 10 chemically, and then I just wouldn't be able to resist it. So people are like, I want to not use drugs, but I keep doing it. Why? Because the dopamine is stronger than you. That's all about anticipation, and anticipation is incredibly powerful. That's in the case of addiction. Now, there are healthy things that you can do as well, but there's always that little bit of anticipation that makes you, it actually does give you some, it does give you some reward, just the anticipation itself. The only thing that I believe that actually where the reward is greater than the anticipation is heaven. That's the deal. You know, that's when we break the bonds of the mortal coil. That's when all of these things, we're no longer prisoners of, you know, what's going on inside the cranium, when the neuromodulators inside our brain are no longer affecting our behavior, and we get to the eternal reward. And that's what my religion and your religion and the religion of many people listening to us, that's what we believe. But heaven isn't earth, and that's the point. You mean, I study neuroscience and social science, and one of the things it does, it brings me closer to God. It always brings me closer to God because it says, Yep, the Bible said that thing, and the science is showing that thing, too.
We'll be right back with more of the Trey Gowdy Podcast.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
Fame. I was trying last night for reasons that I can't explain to you, and I don't know that I could even explain to my psychiatrist why the lyrics from the movie, the song Fame, were going through my head. But for some reason it was. I guess because there was no sports on, all the NCAA basketball games were over. I hadn't started watching my miniseries. But people are going to remember my name. I think that's a line from Irene Cara. So Fame, people, particularly in my old line of work and the one that you worked around, but I was careful not to call you a politician. Fame has become the ultimate virtue or search for whatever. Does being famous make people happy?
Yeah. Answer, of course, is no. As a matter of fact, it's something that we naturally want because Mother Nature wants us to be admired by other people. We are a species. Human beings are a tropical species of primates that live in hierarchical kin groups. Okay, this is academic speak. We were born in Africa where it's nice and warm. And we live in kin groups that are hierarchical, meaning there's an apex person. There's an alpha in these kin groups. And so according to just the basic evolution of how we're formed as human beings, And by the way, we're not bound to this all the time. For example, you know, I live in Boston because humans have been able to invent coats. So I don't have to live in a you know, the environment that continues to be tropical. But I have these tendencies to be hierarchical in kin groups, meaning I want to be at the apex. I want to be the alpha. And I don't know why. I just want it. And one of the ways that I act according to it, because Mother Nature is pushing me. Remember, you're going to get more calories, you're going to get more mates if you're higher in the hierarchy. And so these are primitive instincts that we actually have. Unless we think about it and offer it up in prayer, we're going to be driven by this stuff all the time. Now, maybe it's like, I want to be the CEO. Maybe it's that I want to get elected to Congress. Maybe it's I want 1 million Instagram followers. We all have our crazy way to get it, but it becomes an idol in and of itself because we're driven by this thing that won't make us happy, but it will fill this kind of sense of evolutionary destiny that's wired into our cerebral cortex from, you know, 2.5 million years of development, of human development. Now, that's important knowledge because you can get beyond it. You know, it's funny because St. Thomas Aquinas, you know, in 1265, he writes this important book called the Summa Theologiae, which was, it's a religious text, but it was based on a lot of what Aristotle had written, you know, 500 years before the time of Christ. And one of the things he said is that everybody wants to be happy. And the way that we're going to get happy, like as in the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, is to fulfill God's will. But that's really hard and inconvenient. I mean, it's like lots of rules, man. And so people will go the easy route for something that seems like divine, but isn't. And there are four of those idols: money, power, pleasure, and fame. Anytime that you're doing something that you're going to feel ashamed about later, it's because you're chasing one of those idols, according to Aquinas. And I have the data as a social scientist. He's right. Every single person watching and listening to us right now has one of those idols, usually just one. A lot of people, they want the admiration of other people. They're envious of others and they want to climb the hierarchy. That's fame. Some people, they want the money because they want nice things. Some people, they just chase pleasure all day. They want to just feel good. There's some people who want to have power over others. Money, power, pleasure, fame, figure out your idol and you'll be able to manage your life a lot better.
I do not want to split an atom here unless the atom needs to be split. Fame versus notoriety. I have noticed this kind of lack of shame we have in our culture where I want others to know my name, whether it's for good reasons or bad reasons. And right. We can debate the meaning of good versus bad some other time. But is there a difference between me wanting to be famous and me wanting people to say nice things about me, the accolade part of it?
Yeah.
Or is that the same?
It's based on the same impulse to be noticed, because to stand out is really what the human impulse is all about. Now, to stand out for something you're really good at is even better. That's the ultimate. That's the sine qua non of, like, you know, idolatry excellence is what it comes down to. I want everybody to say, Arthur Brooks is such a smart guy. That's what I want, right? I want everybody to say, I love his books and it's all so awesome. And all. It's so dumb, right? I mean, it's ridiculous. Like I'm turning 60 this year. For what do I want those things, right? Because I mean, I'm not going to be lying on my deathbed and, you know, some years hence, like 60s, by the way, I'm entering a decade that's like the Roach Motel for my family. You know, we check in, but we don't check out of our 60s. So I got to be real careful. And, you know, and what am I going to be doing on my deathbed going, yeah, man, but if I could only get another 10,000 Twitter followers, I mean, it's so dumb, right? But you know, I recognize I got a human brain that's been developed over a couple million years, just like everybody else, is the way that works. So I offer that up in prayer. Now, if you can't get the positive affirmation, to get noticed, you'll get the negative affirmation. And what people, they start to recognize is that they even feel a little bit good, sort of primordially satisfied when people are yelling at them on social media, right? It's scary, but then it stops being scary when people get used to it. You can be basically kind of getting some satisfaction from people hating on you, even as long as they notice you. You know, that's why, you know, Oscar Wilde, the great, you know, British playwright, said the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. Right. And you notice, remember when your kids were little, mine too. I mean, my son Carlos, you know, and my phone has been buzzing this whole conversation because Carlos is calling me now. He's, you know, we're really close, me and Carlos, but he was a tough kid and he was, you know, he was my middle child, man. And, you know, if Carlos couldn't get positive affirmation, he'd take the negative. It's okay, because he became a sniper in the Marine Corps, and he turned all that negative energy on America's enemies, and that was good.
If you need to take Carlos's call, I want you to take Carlos's
call. That's all good. I'll call him right back. He's on the job site. He's actually just got out of the Marines, and he's working this huge construction job that he's in love with, and he probably wants to tell me he's on the 40th floor of an apartment building, and, you know, he's putting up some railings or something.
Good for him. All right. Yeah. I want to – you mentioned that people check in to the Brooks family post 60 hotel, but don't check out. So you also were wise enough, or maybe old enough, to just know that most of what drives people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, we've already figured out. I mean, we've been their age. They've not been our age.
No, that's right. That's right.
So Let me ask it this way. I hope you pass on that roast beef sandwich that you were dreaming about at lunch and go eat some carrots and live to be 100. I hope you live to be 100 if you want to be. But what do you want people to say to Carlos, your other children, your spouse? What do you want them to say when you can't hear it anymore? So the fame doesn't matter. None of that matters anymore. What do you want them to say, others?
You know what I really want to say, you know, and it's what a lot of people listening to this want to have people say about them as well. I want people to say that, you know, Arthur Brooks went to heaven, took as many people with him as he could. That's all I want to say. You know, at the end of the day, I do work in science, and my work is the mission field. You know, the point is that I want people to be happier, because to be truly happier, they need to live in a spirit of love. And there's a transcendence that's actually behind that. Now, I don't have anybody else's path. I'm not, you know, going to kick somebody's door down and shove a crucifix in their face. But the truth of the matter is that if I can set people on the path of love and happiness, and people will say, he set me on the path of love and happiness, then that's a good life, is what it comes down to. Will I be able to hear it? No. But that's how I'm trying to live my life. And I get a lot of satisfaction from that set of goals right now. If my wife can say, he loved me and he loved our family and he loved the Lord, and he loved as many people as he possibly could. You know, that's what I want to do. And I hope that my manifest imperfections don't overtake that before I finally get to the grave.
That would be an amazing legacy. That would be one that I would think, I would hope a lot of people would kind of aspire to. All right. I want to ask you the difference between pride and confidence. Then I'll ask one or two maybe practical questions, and then I'm going to end where you and I started, but we started off air with a myth. Is there a difference between pride and confidence? We think of people who are confident, self-confident, as being good. We think of pride as the original sin and probably the last sin and the one that was most dominant in between. It's not good. What is the difference between the two?
Pride is artificial confidence. And the reason for pride generally is the lack of confidence, is the way that works out. It's an excessive interest in your own victory, in your own success. And that makes you an incredibly brittle, fearful person. People who are truly confident are they recognize the fact that they might fail, and they're comfortable with it. That's where real confidence comes from. But if you're prideful, man, you have an absolute fear aversion. Fear is your, you know, you have a failure death fear is really where, you know, strong pride comes from. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, Dante in his Inferno talked to, it's like at the pit of hell. You know, there's this vision in Dante's Inferno where Satan is actually at the bottom of Mount Purgatory, exhibiting the ultimate sin, which is pride. And what he's doing is he's frozen up to his waist in ice. It's not flames, it's ice. And he's writhing in pain from being in this ice, and his wings are flapping fruitlessly because he's trying to pump himself up. And this is the kind of how pride works. And it's creating this wind, which is so cold that it keeps him frozen. So the whole point is that pride locks you in place in a kind of fake confidence that is actually based on fear. Real confidence, it's equanimity. It's like, you know, real confidence is opening your eyes in the morning and saying, today's another day and I don't know what it's going to bring. I'm really grateful for the good things, but there's going to be things I don't like as well. And all I can say is, bring it on.
All right. I want to ask you, you gave us one thing. We can go to your website if we really want to figure out whether we are a mad scientist, which you have graciously diagnosed me as, and I wish I could argue with you about it, but I can't. You've given us that. Give us something else practical. So maybe people are not happy or content with their current station and they are willing to make changes. What are some practical things people can do to kind of get to where you are, which seems like content in your own skin, and you have conquered the need to conquer the world, to quote Stephen Pressfield's book. How can other people get there?
Well, to begin with, it's an illusion that I'm contented. You know, I'm a very good actor when it comes to happiness, because it's a bad look to have people see me being, you know, really insecure. But the truth of the matter is that, man, I'm super ambitious still. I've just been able to channel my ambition into this thing that's supposed to lift people up and bring them together in bonds of happiness and love. And that's ultimately what we need. So a lot of people listening to us, it's okay if you're not contented. It's okay if you've got a burr under your saddle. It's all right if there's a pebble in your shoe. Just make sure that that pebble is about love for other people and lifting other people up. That's really what that pebble should be all about. And then it can be used for good, because then it's a gift to you, to be sure. But to be more, to have higher levels of well-being such that you can manage your unhappiness and increase your happiness, that's an important set of skills based on knowledge. So it's not just, I hope I feel better. No. Feelings are just emotions, and emotions are nothing more than signals about the outside world. Learn about what the techniques are so you can change your habits and share them with others. That's really what it comes down to. I want everybody to be a happiness teacher. I need colleagues. I need friends that are going to help me in this movement to teach people about where real happiness comes from. On my website, there's actually a workshop that people can take in 10 like half hour sessions to learn about the basic science of happiness in common terms. It's not like jargon about the brain, which is the world that I live in. It's in very, very ordinary terms that people can understand and share with their families around the dinner table or the colleagues at work or whatever. And the last book that I wrote with Oprah Winfrey and I, we co-authored a book called Build the Life You Want, The Art and Science of Getting Happier. That came out last September. And that's a book that's written for, you know, people who are very interested in ideas, but they don't have time to go to get a PhD. It's the science for everybody is what it comes down to. And so inform yourself, make a commitment to change your habits, share that love with other people, and you're well on your way to getting a lot happier, which I really have because of this.
We'll be right back with more of the Trey Gowdy podcast. All right. I have to flash my cynicism at least once before you go to the Himalayas. Politics to me seems to make people incredibly unhappy unless they're being ratified or validated. I mean, just talking to people who disagree with them, even within the like so-called same tribe, they'd rather fight than do anything else. So if it brings so much unhappiness, why do people spend so much time doing it and talking about it?
People do a lot of things that bring them momentary satisfaction, but ultimately lower their happiness. People take methamphetamine, even though it lowers their happiness, because it increases their momentary satisfaction. People will, you know, engage in all kinds of immoral behaviors and what they look at, because it gives them momentary satisfaction, even though they know it's going to lower their happiness. And, you know, looking at pundits and you know, commentary on social media about politics is one of the things that fits into that category. It's a vice, Trey. People actually engage in the vice because it gives them this momentary satisfaction of I'm right. Even though if they think about it clearly, they realize I'm less happy, but I'm right. And that rightness gives me a little burst of this this neurochemical dopamine right now. You know, in the same way that drugs or alcohol would do it, or a little bit of gambling or something that you're looking at on the internet you're ashamed of will actually do the same thing. It is basically ideological pornography is what a lot of people are engaged in, and it's a big problem. Now, a lot of people are able to escape that vortex. The loudest voices are the ones who are kind of trying to productize each one of us. Now, one of the things I'd like people to recognize is when you hate for political reasons, you become somebody's product. Don't be somebody's product. Politics is not that important. It shouldn't actually become a barrier between you and your sister-in-law. She's your sister-in-law. She would take your phone call at 3 a.m. when you're in distress. That is a lot more important than whether or not she likes Trump or Biden or whomever. So keep things in proper perspective and don't become a slave of your brain chemistry. Get off the vice. Turn it off, man, because that stuff is just not good for you.
I tell people, because I have family members who are very, very, very to the left of where people perceive I am. I don't know that I am where they perceive I am, but people perceive I'm certain place. And I tell them that there is no policy worth a relationship to me. There's just no, first of all, arguing about it is not going to change either one of our minds. Yeah. You don't win an argument, but there's just no policy worth the person. I'd rather I have the relationship.
Right.
Let me ask you one theological question and then one kind of philosophical question. And then I'm going to go let you go return Carlos's phone call and eat your roast beef sandwich, despite knowing that people check into the 60s and don't check out in your family.
It's okay. I eat it lean, man. I eat it real lean. They got to get all kinds of, you know, animal protein, man.
Paul claimed he had a burden or something, a pebble in his shoe that he couldn't get around. I never said what it was. There are lots of theories. What do you think it was?
So there's a bunch of scientific theories about that. He talked about his, he used all kinds of different metaphors for it, but he used it as an example of the weakness that actually was his strength. And he would talk about his weakness as a person. And it was never quite specific about it. Almost certainly the early Christian communities knew what it was because they knew him. Now, one big theory that we're actually getting from neuroscientists today is that he actually had major epilepsy. And that would be one of the explanations for what would have happened in his Road to Damascus experience, where he had temporary blindness, where he had a flash of light. He had a very strong metaphysical experience. He heard Jesus talking to him, you know, in convents. When nuns believe they have an apparition of the Blessed Virgin or of Jesus Christ himself, the first thing that the Roman Catholic Church does is they check the nuns for epilepsy, because this actually gives this experience, a strong metaphysical or transcendental set of experiences. So some people believe that he had frontal lobe epilepsy, and that was the thorn in his side that he talked about metaphorically in his letters. That's one possibility. And, you know, you might say that's not right, because that's not consistent with the idea that that's actually God. That, you know, his experience on the road to Damascus was actually Jesus's voice. Why not? Why not? Why isn't that, you know, how Jesus was speaking to him? I mean, far be it from me to tell Jesus or the Lord how he's going to affect St. Paul's brain. But, I mean, I'm just a scientist, man. That's above my pay grade. Other people believe that he had the same set of basic temptations, that the thorn in his side was worldly temptations of fame, or he was attracted to women in ways that were untoward, and he recognized it and admitted it, which would be a very smart move for him to do, to say, look, you know, I'm going to Corinth. You know, the Corinthians were living in the most vice-ridden community. This was the Las Vegas of the ancient world. And if he's going to Corinth and going like, I know, there's temptation all around. I feel it. I'm one of you. That could have been what he was talking about as well. So whether it was frontal lobe epilepsy or whether or not it was, you know, the temptations of the flesh, one way or the other, he was offering it up as the way that he was saying, look, I'm a big, important evangelist, but I'm no different than any of you, because I'm human just like you. And not only can I get beyond these weaknesses, but these weaknesses are my source of strength and they're yours too.
Everything from epilepsy to the modern day or the then day Halle Berry. That is a very wide chasm of things. And it could have been all of the above. I don't know. I always thought maybe it was pride that he thought too highly of himself, or maybe the guilt for the role he played with Stephen. But I wanted to ask you, because you're a smart guy. So we're going to end with somebody that I told you off air that I, for health reasons, have now begun to take a very disquieting form of pleasure in picking up rocks in my backyard and putting them in a wheelbarrow. And my wife thinks it's ridiculous because there are always more rocks, and I don't do anything with the rocks. It is simple-minded, it is mundane, and I derive pleasure from it. And it's what Camus talked about with the myth of Sisyphus, rolling the rock up to do it every day. Is it possible? Is it likely? How do we derive pleasure from what others perceive to be boring, mundane, rote, routine? How do we do that?
So you have a complicated life, Trey. I mean, you have the life of the mind. You have an active mind and you're a mad scientist. That means that you're going to need to rest sometimes. How do you rest? That's what it comes down to. And for you, resting is not sitting on the couch. You need to rest your brain. You need to get to your default mode network, which is what neuroscientists call the console of tissue in your brain that becomes activated when you're not actively thinking about a problem, thinking about a thing. It's usually easiest to access those states of equanimity when you're doing something that's actually not taxing for you intellectually. It's something that requires that you do a thing, but it's a thing where you can get into a state where your brain can go into you know, start cycling in ways that's calmer for you. And a lot of people do it in different ways. I pray as a Catholic, I pray my rosary every day. And my rosary is the same prayers again and again and again. And it's doing the same thing. I use beads where it's like one bead and then again and then again. I'm picking up rocks. Now, one thing you might do, by the way, is you actually might, when you're picking up rocks, have something that will actually make it even better, is if you have something that you say while you're picking up the rocks. There's a lot of neuroscience research on why this works. The Russian Orthodox monks, the further east you get into Russia, the more and more it looks like Eastern religions almost, although it's still pure Christianity, don't get me wrong. And they have a prayer, they have a cord with knots on it. And they'll pray thousands of times a day, this little prayer on their breath, where their inhale will be, Lord Jesus Christ. And on the out breath, it'll be, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. I've been saying that every night for 15 years as I go to sleep. As a matter of fact, it's really good for going to sleep, but it's really good for doing these mundane tasks. And so what you might do, if you want even more benefit from that, is you pick up a rock and you say, Lord Jesus Christ. You put it in a wheelbarrow, you say, have mercy on me. And it's emblematic of this effort that you're trying to make and the journey that you're actually making through your life and where you want it to end up.
And I guess the beauty in repeating the same thing is that you're not working your brain, which is the thing that you're trying to kind of get to. Because I was going to ask you, if you're a mad scientist, how do you turn your brain off?
I do the best I can, man. And one thing, I don't use substances. I don't use alcohol. That's something that doesn't agree with my family, if you know what I mean. And yeah. So, you know, out of self-defense, I stay away from the alcohol. But also, it's a really messy drug for turning off your brain because it lowers your stress in the moment, just like a switch. It'll turn off your anxiety, but it will turn it on higher the next day when you come back and your neurochemistry is trying to revive itself. And so the result of that is that those artificial means are not so good. Having some way for it actually to deal with the storm inside your head, the tumultuous that's going on between your ears, man. It's like, for me, it's, and I got to turn it off. And so I do that a lot with my prayer life.
Arthur Brooks, I could talk to you all day. And I am sure that sometimes when we talk, it does feel to you like it's been all day.
I love talking to you. Are you kidding? This therapy for me.
This excitement and this energy. And I actually love what you said, that you are trying to get to heaven and take as many people as you can with you. That is both a simple and incredibly complex mission statement. That is, which is why it's yours. It is really complex, but when you say it, you think, oh gosh, of course. ArthurBrooks.com, if people want to take the test and they don't need to send it to you to be graded, right? They can see for themselves.
It's all right there. There's a little lecture, a little video lecture for each one of the types that you'll hear from me talking about what it means and how to use it.
All right. Well, you've written a book with the most famous person on earth. Is there, who's next? Jesus, I don't know if he's willing to be a co-author. He's already written one book. I mean, who's next?
I'm trying to get Jesus' literary agent on the phone. I can't set it up. You know, it turns out that I think his publications are pretty complete at this point. His catalog is done. I don't know. I mean, I'm working on a book right now about for young people about how to start, you know, how to, you know, it's called All Things New. And it's about how to start or restart your life. You know, what should you do tomorrow morning? What should you do when you're starting a romance? What should you do when you're looking for a job? What should you do when you first move to a new place? All things new. That's what my next book is about. It's going to come out next year.
Is it already written or are you still working on it?
I'm working on it. A lot of it's like, it's still in here, still trapped in here a little bit. So I think my editor at Penguin Random House is getting a little nervous. Just let it out. Let's see the words.
We use the same publisher, although you would be the thoroughbred and the stable, and I would be a pack mule that is carrying the hay to feed you.
I love your stuff. I mean, that's right. I love it when you write. It's really good.
Well, I'm working on fiction now, so it's harder to get fact checked when you write fiction. So that's my goal, is to avoid being fact checked.
You know, there's one thing about fiction. Maybe this is a good last word. You know, nonfiction is one thing, you know, just about facts. But when you read a novel, there's really an important thing to understand about a novel, which is that the writer, in this case, Trey Gowdy, starts in the middle of a character's life and then imagines everything going forward. That's why fiction is so amazingly optimistic. And one of the best techniques for all of us to be happier, and this is one of the reasons that Easter is such an important understanding of human life, is that it really is all things new. You know, your life is like a book that you're writing, and it starts today in the middle of your life, but fundamentally it starts today and goes forward, and you get to write it. So a lot of people who are feeling really anxious and depressed, it's because they're looking backward. If you think of your book as your life as a novel that starts today, right, then you get to lay it out and say, okay, this is a whole backstory. This is a whole set of things that are going on. But fundamentally, this is looking out the windshield. This is a novel going forward. So think of your life as a book that you're writing. Lay it out. And then as you're writing, it's going to change a little bit for sure. But lay it out as, you know, a story of love and reconciliation with other people and adventure and opportunity and fun, and life will change starting today. That's kind of the Easter message in a lot of ways.
That is a beautiful way to conclude. The one thing in the world we can do nothing about is yesterday. I mean, it's human nature is to maybe regret and reminisce a little bit, but it's the one thing that we just can't do anything about. So, all right, you got some big events coming up in your life. You got trips, you got classes, and you got books. Thank you for checking in with us again. My wife will be extremely happy, and I cannot wait till the next time we visit.
Me too, Troy. Thank you. Thank you for the work that you're bringing, lifting people up. I appreciate it a lot.
Yes, sir. You take care of yourself. Dr. Arthur Brooks, he earned it for the PhD program. Y'all have a great week. Thank you for joining us. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.